everyone, and welcome to the Bubble Hour, where real people tell real stories of addiction and recovery. A few weeks ago, I shared audio from the Recovery Today series that last September I was featured on, and I was interviewed by Sherry Gaba, the creator and editor of Recovery Today magazine, who is a psychotherapist and a coach with so much on the go, it is hard to even know where to start. Now, you may know Sherry from her work on Celebrity Rehab, or perhaps you've read one of her several books or e-books on recovery and relationships. Maybe you subscribe to Recovery Today magazine, or perhaps you took part in her annual online series, which just marked its fifth year. In any event, after hearing Sherry interview me on that recent episode, many of you let me know you wanted to hear more from her. So here she is. Her latest book, The Marriage and Relationship Junkie, was released on Valentine's Day and became an overnight bestseller. Sherry, congratulations, and welcome to the Bubble Hour.
Oh, Jen, thank you. Thank you for I meant Jean. It's Jean, correct? Oh, my God, I can't believe I said Jen. So sorry.
I know we're both stumbling over each other's names today. Oh, wow.
God, was that really me? All those things you just mentioned, I'm like, oh, no wonder I'm spinning around and around and around. I do a lot, don't I?
You do, and I'm sure that doesn't even cover it all. I know that you're just a busy lady, and you've got a big heart, and you love to help people, don't you?
Well, you know, I became a social worker to do just that, and, you know, just by a whole bunch of series of things that occurred, I started in hospice, you know, working with patients that were dying and dealing with that sort of loss, and then eventually just kind of morphed into the field of addiction and dealing with those losses, only to marry someone that was in recovery, only to divorce the person that was in recovery or relapsed, and all this stuff fell together. I ended up getting a job at a Malibu rehab known as Promises, where all the celebrities go, and then I got invited to do Celebrity Rehab, and then suddenly I was asked by a big publisher, you know, to write a book, and so everything just kind of fell into place pretty organically. But I do work hard, but I love what I do, and I'm passionate about it, and even more so than ever, really, to change the stigma around addiction and to support the families of those that love addicts and alcoholics.
Do you feel like it's changing? I mean, you're doing a lot, and I love the work that you're doing. I wonder what it feels like from you having sort of seen the arc of this. Do you feel like we're kind of at a watershed moment, or is there a lot more to be done?
You know, I think what I'm seeing, even since I started in this field, is that there's a lot more opportunities and choices out there. I think a lot of the young people today, maybe even some of the people that are middle-aged and older, are wanting some new modalities, some new ways of looking at recovery. I had the opportunity to interview the Refuge Recovery's founder, Noah Levine, last week, and so he's kind of taking Buddhism and Zen and bringing it to recovery, and you and I know a lot of really amazing women that are doing different things. She recovers and so forth. So I'm excited that there's this freshness and there's a place for everyone, because for me, the reason I wrote my book, The Law of Sobriety, was because people really love this idea of law of attraction meets recovery. Like, they love this idea of infinite intelligence. They love this idea of what you attract, or what you put in the universe, or what you create is what you get back. And it really spoke to a lot of people, and that was like, you know, that was back in 2010. And now I'm just seeing more and more of these things morphing, and I think it's, again, allowing people to not just have to go to a 12-step meeting. Again, I love, you know, I am a big proponent of the 12 steps. I belong to a program myself, but it isn't always for everyone. So that's what I love. I think there's just more opportunity to pick and choose what it is that works for you in your recovery.
I love that. We often hear people on this show use the term patchwork recovery. Actually, often hear me use it, talking to other people.
Oh, okay.
William White kind of coined that term for the sort of smorgasbord approach, because there, as you say, there's so many excellent modalities, and you know, it's important to stick to recovery and to stick to our abstinence-based recovery, especially. Your dog's barking. My dog barks.
My dog's barking, so I just picked her up so that we can not have that.
What's your dog's name?
My dog is Mocha. Mocha is my buddy, and she's just the best watchdog. Even though she's very little, she has a very ferocious bark. But you know, even the dog barking is sort of a patchwork of the messiness of life. Like, things are just not always the way we see them.
No,
or
that's
the way we
right.
Want them to be.
It gives us all that Me Too moment, right? I've had lots of things happen on this show. Usually my mom calls at some point, and you can hear the answering machine going off in the background because I still have an old school answering machine. I mean, that is life.
And I think if we're in recovery of whatever we're in recovery from, we have to be okay with that. Things just aren't. I think a lot of us are even recovering from being perfect. So I think when things do happen, like a dog barks or your machine goes off, I think it's just a great example of, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect.
Right. That is a very good point. And just before we went to air, Sherry and I were both checking our lines and trying to make sure we had a good connection. And at the last moment, I went racing through my house to grab a different phone because my speakers weren't quite connecting right. About 30 seconds before this recording started, our listeners will appreciate that Sherry, the consummate professional, was telling me, just stay calm, just relax.
Well, you know, what I find really fascinating is that we both put out into the universe the intention to have a really special interview, and lo and behold, the universe answered our call, and now we have made a great line and great connection.
Yes, that's right. Dogs and all. Well, let's just go back to what we were talking about, which was we were talking about the patchwork, the idea of a patchwork recovery and making use of all different kinds of things that are now available. And do you feel like the fact that people are just talking more openly about things is helpful, not only for people who are considering, you know, the sober curious types, but also maybe family members or those around them that are affected by shame or stigma or just misinformation? How do you see that changing?
I think there's less judgment. You know, when I was on Celebrity Rehab back in 2008, 2009, there were a lot of naysayers. A lot of people, you know, wrote me and said, oh, my God, how can you take recovery and put it on TV? It's an anonymous program. And then maybe a handful of people even died that had been on the different seasons. I think there were 5 seasons. And then I got, you know, emails like, oh, you know, your program wasn't really a program. Look what happened to this person and that one. And there was so much judgment. I mean, the bottom line is it was a program, and they were getting support. And it was really the first time that rehab like that, except maybe for the show Intervention, actually introduced, like, this is what happens when you go into a treatment center. And it took the fear out for a lot of people. And more importantly than that, the celebrities that were on the show, they needed recovery. They didn't have the ability to go to treatment. If they didn't have the show to go on, they might not have gotten sober. And many of them are still sober. So I think, to answer your question, because that just kind of spoke to me, was the idea that there's less shame and there's less judgment. And I have a really hard time with black or white thinking. I think that life is about an and. Like, there's this and there's that. It doesn't have to be one way or the other because, you know, as addicts, alcoholics, or codependents, love addicts, which I am, we tend to be very black or white. We tend to be all or nothing. So if we're in a program that's very all or nothing, I think it just creates less openness. However, with that said, I don't want to judge the people that strictness, that one way of looking at things works for someone, great. Like, if that's working, that one direction of looking at things, that's awesome. What I love is that whole old concept that I heard in, you know, AA a long time ago, and I've heard it in Al-Anon, is take what you can and leave the rest. So I just want, you know, everyone to have the ability to sort of pick and choose what works for them so that they can have a really great, joyous, peaceful, serene life.
You know, mentioning Celebrity Rehab, I have to say that show, I'm sure others had the same experience with it, I was drinking. I was deep into my pattern when I discovered that show, and
uh-huh.
I think that it planted seeds for me. I would listen. I would listen to the therapy sessions or to, you know, just questions that that would be asked of the people that were in care. And I would think, oh, why is that important? Oh, well, what's that about? Oh, you know, and I would have a few little, like, pings of, oh, okay. I mean, I wasn't ready maybe to make a change, but I was gearing up. And so I'm really grateful to every participant in that show because they gave service to me, and I'm sure millions of others feel the same way.
Yeah,
maybe even people that were a little bit scared by it or put off by it might understand, too, that it might have shone a light on something for them. So I think it did a lot of good.
I think so. I'm so, you know, I love hearing that. Thank you for sharing that because that's what the intention was. The intention was really pure. And sure, it was, you know, a show and they had producers, but, you know, nothing was ever staged. You know, I mean, the things that I would hear, you know, that people thought was going on was just not the case. I mean, what people don't realize is that I was the therapist behind the scenes. So even though you would maybe see the counseling or the group counseling or you'd see Drew doing a session, there was always therapy for these people out after, you know, everything was filmed, not everything got on air, but they always mm-hmm. had therapy and therapists mm-hmm. there available to them. So, mm-hmm. You know, it was a great program for so many.
Let's talk about your book a little bit. The new one is
sure.
Marriage and Relationship Junkie, and you had mentioned, you know, your experience personally with feeling codependent and just seeing a correlation between how people act out in different ways, different symptoms, I believe you used, was the word that you used for it in an earlier discussion we had. So tell me about this book, and then let's talk about any commonalities between addicts of alcohol or drugs and addicts of relationships.
That's a great question. Well, I'm really proud of the book. It came out, like you said, February 7th. And it did become a bestseller in substance abuse and codependency, and it was endorsed by Melody Beatty, who wrote the book Codependent No More, and she's a dear friend and colleague of mine, and just so grateful for her. The book really sort of takes a lot of people know about love addiction, relationship addiction. This kind of goes a step further and talks about marriage addiction, which is not something people talk about. But there is a lot of shame. And so that would be one comparison, is that there's shame in addiction and there's shame in marriage addiction or substance abuse addiction and marriage addiction. I have been married multiple times. I am a total love, relationship, marriage addict in recovery. I spent a great deal of my life in relationships so that I could avoid the emptiness, the core abandonment, you know, feelings that were just so deep inside of me. I was so wounded inside that the only thing I thought could fix it was the love of someone else versus the love of loving myself and being enough within myself. And the whole point of this book is that if one person is thinking about, you know, because we still live in a society where, you know, the white picket fence, although a lot of millennials are not getting married, they're actually living together. But if one person out there can say, you know, am I making this decision from the right place, or am I doing this out of emptiness or loneliness or, you know, desperation or craving or wanting to fit in or thinking no one will ever want me or blah, 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 I have done my job. And, you know, I'd been a very young single mother, and I wanted that, quote, family. And so I kept trying to create this illusion, this family, this illusion that was never, never going to happen. I mean, it was because my intentions were not from the right place. And so that is really what the book is about learning how to step into your yourself, step into your self-love, not settling, knowing that you're worthy and deserving of everything you could possibly want. And again, it's taking a step further from love addiction to the idea that you don't have to be married to be happy. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And is it the romance of the ceremony or the losing yourself in another person or just the excitement, you know, that like dopamine high or whatever? What is love? Is it dopamine? What is the high that we get from
It is sort of a dopamine high. It's actually the same fix that someone would get if they wanted a heroin fix. It's actually the same sort of feeling. And when the relationship would end, for me, I would go into withdrawal. I really would. And I'd be like, oh, my God. And I would get into panic, and I would get into terror. And, you know, it's embarrassing to talk about, but I sometimes share, and I've shared this many times, and it sometimes will help people if they hear the story, but I had been premature the time I was born. If you had a premature baby, moms were not allowed to bond with the babies. They actually, I did not meet my mother for 3 months. I was 3 pounds. I was in an incubator. Nowadays, we know that, social workers go to mothers' homes and they teach them how to, like, give extra love and extra nurturing and extra care and extra touch. They didn't do any of that when I was born. And so I literally was born, like, in terror. Like, I really did not have the bonding or the attachment that is so important in, you know, when you're a newborn. So that really set me up for a lifetime of looking for the love I didn't get at that early time. And I like to share the story because I think there are people out there that will be able to relate. And, you know, they may be able to relate in a different way. Like, they may be somebody that might have had alcoholic or addict parents that weren't available. They might have been people that had parents that were neglecting them. They might have had a single parent that was so busy and occupied that they didn't get the attention they needed. And so they might have felt invisible. They might have felt like, you know, their feelings didn't count. They weren't, they just weren't available. They were maybe neglected. And so, you know, when you grow up like that, you know, it kind of leaves a hole inside of you. And, you know, I think that, too, again, it can be very similar to addiction, that feeling, you know, substance abuse, where you just feel so empty and the only way you know how to fill it up is with a substance. So whether it's love, food, sex, you know, gambling, I mean, Gabor Mate, he's a pretty renowned speaker in this field. I mean, his addiction was going and buying CDs. You know, and that was his, you know, he had been a child of a Holocaust survivor, and so he, too, didn't get his needs met. And then we're just getting back into the idea of trauma. I think that the things that addicts, all addicts, whatever the addiction is, a lot of them have trauma or they have a mental health, you know, issue like depression or anxiety. I think they have underneath codependency. I think when I think about my ex-husband's story, I think it's the codependency that has taken him down more than anything else, even though he is an active alcoholic. I think that a lot of fear runs the gamut with most addicts. So I think there's so many similarities between all of these addictions. And it's just it's what's missing inside. It's feeling not enough. It's feeling less than. It's not feeling connected to yourself. Is really what it comes down to. And I'm a big believer in trauma therapy, which is something I did that really just was a life changer for me. Once I did that work, it just made such a difference in me being able to be with me.
What is trauma therapy?
I did something called somatic experiencing. It's Peter Levine's book. There's a great book out there called Waking the Tiger that talks about the fight-flight response. Other trauma therapy is EMDR. There's tapping, and
okay,
all of
EMDR is eye movement, right? Where you revisit old memories and you're led through eye movement. Tapping? Tell me about tapping.
So tapping is where we have different energy centers in our body, what we call chi. And when we get stuck in a thought or an addiction or a feeling of like we're not in touch with our body, we have to sort of move the energy. And so what tapping does is actually moves energy. It moves the energy so you kind of get unstuck. Let's say you're obsessing over someone you love, or let's say you're obsessing over wanting to drink, or maybe you have really bad depression, or maybe you're in crippling fear. You do this series of tapping at different center points in your body, different chi centers. I can't think of the word. You know, like it's the center, it's what acupuncture is. It's basically acupressure you're doing to yourself. So maybe I'm looking for the word acupuncture points. I don't know if do you know what I'm talking about, Jean? Like there's
sort of pressure points. Yeah, I do, but I don't know the
pressure
right
pressure point,
for it.
Yes.
I feel like I would have at one point listened to this and thought this sounded all way too woo-woo for me. But there's there is good science behind it. This really is about sensory and brain activation, and there is there's something scientific going on. It isn't just sort of an idea, right? I mean, it really you can measure the body's response to this.
Well, what we know is that talk therapy doesn't work alone. I'm also a licensed clinician, like a licensed psychotherapist, and, you know, I do some of the talk therapy, of course. But we know that when you have these early trauma experiences like I had, it isn't enough to just talk. You actually have to release that energy that's been blocked. And once you release that energy, then you get back in your body and you can be with yourself. Because really what addiction is, it's wanting to run away from yourself.
Right.
You're like in terror. And so I spent my whole life, you know, looking for other people to fill me up because I was so afraid of just me being in my own skin.
Mm-hmm.
I never learned how to be in my own skin. It, you know, there I was crying in that incubator. And again, you know, some people may be on the call going, oh, come on, get over it. That was, you were just a baby. You don't remember. Well, we know for sure that there is cell memory, that the things that you may not remember in your brain, your body absolutely remembers.
We've talked on this show a number of times as well that people that have been adopted have a higher incidence of addiction and alcoholism. The assumption there is that comes from attachment disruption as babies too. So I could completely believe that these experiences would have, just deeply buried traumatic effect.
For sure. I mean, here you are, you're in your little mommy's womb and you're hearing her voice every day. And then all of a sudden you're coming out into the world. She's gone. Like it completely has more or less abandoned you in a way, not necessarily meaningful, you know, not meaning to, but that's kind of what it is. And you're suddenly relying on strangers. You might not be picked up like you would have been picked up by your mother. There may not be that attunement. You know, I think you're a mom, right, Jean?
I am, and a grandma.
You are, yeah. So think about when you were mirroring your babies and you were looking into their eyes. You know, I'm a new grandma. I have a 2-year-old granddaughter, and I just get to be so present with her, and I look at her eyes, and I connect, and there's this attunement, and that's how security is developed, and that's how, good attachment is developed and gives you the ability to kind of explore the world but know that you're safe and all of that. Well, if you don't get that, you can imagine the kind of havoc that would play on your body, your wiring system, you know, your energy. And so, I'm glad that you do see that there is scientific evidence with all of this stuff. I mean, waking the tiger is somatic experience, which is based on Peter Levine's work, which is the book Waking the Tiger, is absolutely scientifically based, that we know we have a fight-flight response, and you can either flee or fight, and for many of us, we freeze. And the freezing is that's what the work is to unfreeze you, to get rid of all of that energy that's been blocked and frozen.
That's a good way to describe it. And, I've had these moments over the past many years of sobriety and recovery where I sort of think of them as like fireworks moments almost, where someone, I'll just hear a word in a conversation or in a sharing circle that is one of those aha moments where I realize something I always just thought was true or took for granted has a name and is a thing and can be changed. And those have been really explosive moments for me in my recovery. And one of those moments was just a friend in a group of sober women where we were talking about our lives and our experiences. And one friend used the term maladaptive coping strategy. And I just had one of those like light bulb moments where I could just see all of these things that I hated about myself or that I didn't understand about myself and that I thought were me were maladaptive coping strategies and could be changed. And I wonder if when you were doing your training or earlier perhaps even when you heard about things like attachment theory or about babies' responses to their moms, were you having these aha moments about your own life or did that come later? How did that unfold for you?
Oh my God, Jean, you're so intuitive. That is exactly what happened. I did learn about attachment theory in school, But it wasn't until I actually went into this training called somatic experiencing. It was, you know, to get certified in this line of work, you know, to add sort of another modality to my therapy practice. And it was life-changing, and it was exactly what I needed. I always knew there was something kind of wrong with me. You know, like when I was growing up and my parents would go out of, you know, town, or they'd go out on a Saturday night, my brother would be like, bye, have a good time. And I'd be crying and so sad, and I didn't want them to leave me, and I just always knew I was different. And, you know, you hear that from alcoholics, too. They'll say, I just knew I was different. I just didn't feel a part of, or whatever. And, yes, when I went to this training, I had the biggest aha moment, and I was able to put a word to it. And I realized, oh, my God, I definitely had early trauma issues that never got addressed. And you have no idea what it's like to suddenly be a present person. I was so in my head and so just this narrow focus, and it's kind of like being under an umbrella, and then you take the umbrella away, and all of a sudden there's a whole world. And that's really what happened for me when I did this work, is I suddenly could be in my body. I could tolerate the moment. I could tolerate being present. You know, I still get out of my body sometimes, and I get into things like workaholism or, you know, codependency sometimes, you know, rears its ugly head. And then I just have to, like, wake up all over again and go, okay, what's going on here? Let's ground our feet. You know, let's kind of notice our breath and notice where's the energy in our body that, you know, is sort of not here. Let's kind of bring it back to here. And, you know, like in the program they talk about turning it over. It's kind of the same thing. It's like continually to waking up. And that's really what I've learned to do, and I kind of learned how to do it kind of later in life. So I hope some of these young people that are listening to this and get the support out there if they're feeling like they can't be present, or they're disassociated, or they know there's something wrong, and they can't be alone. They have to be in relationship, or of course those that are struggling with addiction or substance abuse.
Yeah, I'm so excited when I see young people that are working on this stuff in their 20s. Any age,
imagine?
Though. I mean, actually, every time I see someone at any stage of life working on it, I think it's amazing. I mean, there's 80-year-olds getting sober, you know? There's 18-year-olds getting sober. And it is amazing at every stage. But it's really beautiful that you're taking what you've learned and putting it forward and maybe sparing someone else, you know, a painful lesson. I mean, I always think that we can learn from each other. We don't have to learn everything ourselves.
Right. I mean, everything's lessons, and everybody's going to make mistakes and all of that. But, you know, I actually got married at 22, and it was, if I would have known then what I know now, I'm grateful because I have a beautiful daughter and a beautiful granddaughter, and it was all supposed to be, but there was a lot of pain, you know, a lot of relationships that I didn't have to go through if I would have known or, you know, had done this work earlier. I think it would have just completely changed my life. And the good news is now I'm here to help others around it and help others work through these things. You know, maybe when they're, you know, before they have to make all these, because life is a series of choices, you know. And I think that if we can make decisions in a place of groundedness and in a place where we're regulated in our systems, in our bodies, if we're connected to ourselves, I mean, all of these decisions will be so much more effective for your life.
Mm, yeah. Now, we talked a little bit about different aspects or different symptoms of that disconnect from self. Your book looks at substituting relationship for comfort and security, and how that same ism comes out in shopping and eating disorders. And there's a lot of, I've heard it called fellow travelers, you know, there's a lot of sort of comorbidities or dual diagnosis that people have. And as I was reviewing your book, and I was thinking, you know, all apples are fruits, but not all fruits are apples. And I wondered if there's any correlation when it comes to codependency and being addicted to relationships and marriage. Is alcoholism common in that demographic, and is codependency common in alcoholism and addiction?
You know, that's a great, great question. Jean, you're just an amazing interviewer. I love your insight and intuition. You really are. I have, you know, I'm a fellow interviewer, so when I meet someone that can do this job really well, I'm like, wow, this is awesome. Because believe me, there's some people that don't interview quite this well. But anyway, what I do know, and I really do know this, is that I do believe most of the addicts and alcoholics that I have met, underneath there is codependency. There just is. There's a lot of that because it's an other, codependency is an other focused disease. It's all about what's going on outside of me. It's looking for something on the outside that really is in the inside. Just like they're looking towards their substances, they're looking towards people, places, or things. They're looking for attention, or they're looking for validation, or they're looking for acknowledgement. So I see a lot of codependency under addiction and alcoholism. You can be a codependent without being a love addict. Like, you can be a codependent, in other words, maybe you're a people pleaser at work, or maybe you don't know how to say no to people, or you don't have good boundaries, but that doesn't mean that you're a love addict. But certainly if you're a love addict, there are definitely codependent characteristics. You know, there absolutely is, because you're depending on something outside of yourself to make you feel good on the inside, which is part of what codependency is. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And it's interesting from that perspective, too. So it leads me to the question that does everything heal in a similar way? Do the same principles that help us quit drinking help us heal codependency and relationship addiction? What's the recovery process that you take people through, and how does it vary from different symptoms?
Well, I think recovery is pretty much the same throughout, no matter what the addiction is. So the kind of process that I like to look at is, first, there's that first step of awareness, you know, that waking up to the issue, which maybe people would say is the first step, realizing that your life has become unmanageable. But the first step would be awareness. And then the next is making a decision to change, and then learning to stop looking for external solutions for your problems, exploring your personal fears, moving out of denial, examining those early suppressed trauma issues that you might have, that you had in childhood. Really doing a lot of self-parenting work. I mean, really loving that, you know, that little Jean or that little Sherry.
Mm-hmm.
Becoming a really loving and forgiving and compassionate person to yourself. That's a big one. Like, so often codependents they care so much about everybody else, they forget to care about themselves or have compassion for themselves.
Right.
And then using the pain to grow and prepare for a healthy relationship or a healthy life. And trusting in yourself and letting go. And then, you know, finding things.
Does it have to come in that order, Sherry? It's like, what has to be the first thing?
You know, I don't think it has to be in that order, but I do think the first one is pretty important, awareness. I think awareness and denial, I mean, getting out of denial, I think that's huge, you know, because it's the denial that keeps you from, you know, making the choice to change. You know, when you know something, you need to get out of a certain, let's say, relationship, or you need to stop drinking, it's so easy to go into denial, because if you go into denial, you don't have to get rid of your goodies, right? So it's that fear of the truth is sort of your desire to use or have a relationship or not be alone is greater than the truth of knowing that this is not good for you.
Is this a real epiphany for a lot of people that, you know, someone that's had numerous marriages or serial relationships that, oh, this isn't just my life unfolding, this is a pattern that I'm contributing to? Is that a hard thing to accept, or is that a welcome idea?
I think it's very hard to accept if you don't want to go through the pain, because that's what people are running from. You know, like, and now we're living in a time with all of these dating apps and internet dating, and it's so disposable to, we can be disposable, but there's so much, I didn't mean to say disposable, there's so much available to just keep, you know, this cycle going of next, next, next. you know, this one doesn't want me, so let's go to the next one. And I don't have to be alone. I can just get on this you know, internet site, or I can get on this dating app. Or I think it's a huge issue, and I think there's more of this addiction being created by the technology that we're living in today, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, no. And what's the antidote for that?
Well, and it goes even deeper than that. I mean, because there's this phenomenon, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, called ghosting.
Yes.
And it's where people just disappear. And so, you know, there you are, you're putting yourself out there, you're making yourself vulnerable, you want to meet someone, and then suddenly someone, you think you've made this, quote, connection, and then somebody disappears and they ghost you. So talk about playing into your abandonment issues. So you better be really secure within yourself and not take anything personal, because there are no rules today. You know, what used to be, like, considered really rude and unacceptable is happening, like, all the time now. Because it can happen, because they're not doing it in person. They're doing it online. They're anonymous. So there's no, quote, ramifications except being a really lousy person to do that to someone. You know what I mean?
Wow. Yeah. That's sad. That makes me sad.
Mm-hmm.
I've often felt grateful that I'm not on the dating scene at 50, you know? I just feel like,
oh, yeah.
Because we were raised in a different environment of communication, and as you say, we're now living in this upside down world where everything is different and all the rules are changing so fast that I would think that us tenderhearted types would be really vulnerable out there. So
it's,
I definitely
it's very
think
difficult.
Yeah, my heart
yeah.
goes out.
But
to
then
the
again,
that are hurt
what
by
I
that.
What I guess what I'm thinking is, it's difficult, but if you get connected to yourself and these things happen to you, they may not feel really good, let's say, you know, for the moment, but you can easily get back and connect to yourself again and go, I'm okay and I'm enough. And what this person thinks of me is really none of my business, or I don't even know this person. Like, you know, in other words, if you've done the work and you're connected to yourself, even though you may be sensitive and it may be hurtful, you can kind of get back into wholeness again. Or hopefully not get out of wholeness, to not really allow this. I think it's hard, though, not, you know, if you're out there and you want to meet somebody, I guess, like you said, if you're tenderhearted, it's going to hurt for a minute. But I think just the more connected we are to ourselves, it doesn't have to hurt as much. But if you haven't done the work, it's going to really set you up for, you know, a lot of feelings of abandonment, I think.
One of the chapters in your book is on the grieving process, and is this what you're talking about, or is there another way that grief plays into healing this part of ourselves?
Well, I think the grieving process is the same whether it's, God forbid, somebody passing away or losing a relationship. It's, you know, you go through those stages of anger and depression, and then that stage called bargaining where you don't understand how this could be happening, or, you know, you think about letting someone back in your life, for instance, and then they disappoint you, and you're like, how did this happen to me? So you kind of get stuck there, and then eventually you move into acceptance and letting go. So that's part of the grieving process. The other part is to really try to have sort of a no-contact rule. Like, if you really feel like you're obsessed with somebody and the relationship is now over, you really want to stay clear of, you know, the texting and the calling and the drive-bys, you know, you just really want to start working on yourself and really try to have a no-contact rule. Just like with alcoholism, if you know you're an alcoholic, that one sip is going to set you up for the craving, and then before you know it, you're, you know, drinking a bottle of vodka. So it's really the same thing with love and relationship addiction, is that if something ends, you need to kind of have no contact, you know, with that person, or maybe dating itself for a while you go through the healing and grieving process.
I'm smiling that you made that analogy because listeners to this show will know that I have on more than one occasion said that to me, like, having alcohol in front of me is like standing naked in a closet with an old boyfriend. Like, don't tempt yourself.
Oh,
no
God,
matter how
I love
much
that.
You say, I'm not going to, nothing's going to happen. Why would you be in that situation? Like, that's just a bad
idea. Oh, my God, that's so true, Jean. That's so true. And, you know, the truth is, and I've done it, you know, I'm not going to go into it today, but we often think that, you know, everything's going to be different. And what is that? Insanity. expecting the same thing and, you know, getting different results. It's just it's not going to happen. It's usually going to be the same.
And grief, I've often heard, and I experienced this myself when I quit drinking, I grieved wine. I grieved wine like it was my best friend, and I had to grieve the loss of my best friend and the lie, the fact that, you know, alcohol lied to me or I lied to myself, and that sadness was enormous and physical. And as you were talking about the stages of grief, I guess bargaining is often where people relapse, right? They're moving through the grief and they start bargaining. Maybe I can moderate. Maybe I can, like you say, maybe I can text him. Like I can just see the correlations between these two.
That reminds me of someone I was speaking to today. I was doing an interview for Recovery Today magazine, and he was an opiate addict, and he was talking about it took him 15 months to really get the opiates out of his system, and he was talking about just climbing out of his skin. And you're absolutely right. There's that point where he kind of went, I don't know if I can do this, and if I don't start to feel better, I want to die, because this is so unbearable. So yeah, I totally get what you're saying. The bargaining is probably the bargaining can also be that moment of clarity too, where you go, wow, I want this, even though it's really uncomfortable and I'm really sad that this person is gone or my painkillers are gone or my alcohol is gone, but I want this. I want to get to the other side of this, because, you know, what we all do is we all kind of like have a default system, whatever that default system is, going back to that old boyfriend or that ex-husband or going back to drinking or whatever your addiction is, going back to shopping or excessive shopping. And it's about getting to the edge of the discomfort so we don't have to go back to that default system. It's like just being on the edge of it and going, okay, I can do this. I know it doesn't feel good, but I can be here because I know that on the other side of this is where my freedom exists.
Ah, so that's a bargain too. The just for today is a bargain with yourself when you're properly motivated. And I like that.
I think it just reminds me of your question about, you know, I can't remember exactly what you said, but it just reminded me that will people do this? Yeah, if they're willing to live in the pain for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
If they're
mm-hmm.
able to just tolerate a little pain, maybe a lot of pain.
Right.
But to know that, you know, everything passes, everything changes. You know, there are no guarantees in life, that everything is temporary.
You know, for a girl that cries during movies and during commercials and things, I had a real fear of breaking down and crying in front of people. And I was in a therapy session one time, and I said to the therapist, like, I can't go, I don't want to talk about this, I don't want to start crying. And she said, you know, you physically can't cry for more than X amount of minutes, and we have more than that amount of time left in our session, so this would be a great time for you to cry.
Oh, that's so funny.
And that was just the greatest gift. It was so...
That girl. She gave, you know what she did? She gave you another perspective.
Right. I don't know what I thought was going to happen, you know, if I cried. But, boy, I just had this belief that it would never end. And I think that's why we run from pain, right? We think it's never going to end. It's going to consume me. And no, it's not. It's going to.
And actually, the crying, as you know, is super healthy. I mean, you're basically discharging energy when you're crying. Like all kinds of things happen when you discharge all that old stuff. You know, whether it could be crying, you feel energy in your body. You could feel sweaty hands. You could have suddenly a pain in your back or your neck, or you know, you might start moving your feet. But all of that is good because you're getting that old stuff out. You know, and it's the stuckness that keeps you stuck in those same patterns and habits that aren't working for you.
So I have a question for you in the last few minutes that we have left, and that is, you know, you said that you've worked with celebrities and you've worked with people that have all different levels of fame, and of course you can't tell stories out of school. I wouldn't ask you to do that, My question is recovery more complicated for people that are famous? Because they're the ones that are in the news, and like in a lot of ways that's shaping the stigma. But do they recover the same way we do, or are there other complicating factors?
Yeah, I would say it can be much more difficult for a couple of reasons. Anyone that does become an actor, actress, or musician, or, you know, you're in the public eye. So when you're in the public eye, there's this scrutiny of what people think of you, or what people, you know, you have this like public persona. And so there's a lot more scrutiny. Then you have what I call the yes people. And the yes people are the ones that are really the enablers, because by keeping you maybe high or keeping you drugged or keeping you in your disease, you know, people aren't going to lose their jobs. Like if you're looking, you know, if you need a fix and that yes person is going to run out and get you what you need, you don't want to lose your job. So you're going to go out and get that person what they need. Do you know what I'm saying? So yes,
yeah.
People is a big issue. And then finally, there's this level of narcissism. Like if you become an actor or actress, there is a part of you that probably has a narcissistic trait, or you may be totally a narcissist. And so that definitely is a huge issue around addiction and being different than, let's say, the average person.
So we were talking earlier about how codependency is a common trait among people with addiction. Can someone be codependent and narcissistic at the same time?
Oh, gosh. That's a great question. I think I'm going to answer it this way. I think you can be anything and you can have different traits. You know, we all can have various traits. So what I would say is yes. Mm-hmm. I would say yes, you can have both for sure. And then I would say this, which is even more important. I think narcissists and codependents attract each other like magnets.
Mm-hmm.
They find each other because the narcissist needs the attention that the codependent is willing to give them. You know, the narcissist is an empty hole that just needs lots of accolades and attention, and they give very little in return, and they're only in that relationship for what they can gain, and then the codependent loses themselves and is willing to give anything to stay in that relationship. So I think that's the more important question. Not that that wasn't a good question, because it was an excellent question, but I think codependents and narcissists are a huge match for each other.
And this is the dance of your book, really, isn't it? That someone who is a marriage and relationship junkie that is steeped in codependence is attracting that narcissistic partner, and that is typically not going to last. That's going to
Not if they're not working on themselves, you know?
Right.
If they're not working on themselves, they're just going to... You know, it's, you know, codependency is a muscle you have to exercise just like addiction.
Hmm.
It's the same muscle. Like you can easily go back into that codependency. You know, it's something you have to be vigilant, just like you have to be vigilant about your own recovery with substance abuse. You've got to be vigilant with codependency because it's out to get you.
Did those relationships that form out of that sort of needy, you know, maladaptive, habitual, symptomatic kind of behavior, can they be saved if both people want to work on them? Is there often enough there to, can they bloom into a true healthy relationship?
It would be a lot of work. They both have to have their own programs, their own therapy, work out some of their childhood issues perhaps. But the thing is, it isn't for us to decide whether it needs to be saved or not. If it's working in their own dysfunctional way, then I guess it's working for them. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, okay, if, you know, there it is, there's that dance, and, you know, we don't want that dance, but they seem to be okay with it, and I guess it's for them to decide.
That's why you're a therapist and I'm not.
I hope I didn't sound too therapeutic on this interview. I don't like to do that. So
you're so open and warm, and I find that is when I talk to people who are really good at this, this is the thing that they're able to do that I haven't learned yet, is allowing people to be and then allowing them to find their way through what they're in and loving them where they're at and meeting them where they're at. And
Right. And just like my sponsor in Al-Anon, you know, always said is, you know, they have their own path and they have their own higher power, or they have their own universal energy that is watching out over them, you know. So we just have to, or even what I learned when I became a social worker, like meet them where they are. You can't work harder than they're willing to work. That's a big one.
So tell me, Sherry, what is next for you? You're always up to something. Do you have a project on the horizon?
Well, I'm so grateful that you gave me this platform to talk about my book, The Marriage and Relationship Junkie, and I hope people will check it out on Amazon. And I have something called Wake Up Recovery. It's just wakeuprecovery.com, and it's a community of people interested in the law of attraction and recovery. And so that's like a huge thing that I'm working on right now. And we have about 30 members, and it's just people that want to dive deeper into the law of attraction. And we just have such a varied amount, group of people. We have people that are recovery coaches. We have people that are recovery counselors. We have people that aren't working recovery at all but are in recovery. We even have some families that don't necessarily have the addiction but have maybe a family member that has an addiction, got some love addicts in there. So it's kind of just a group of people that want to, you know, are in recovery of whatever they're in recovery for, and I think we're all in recovery for something, and then just kind of diving deeper into the law of attraction. So they can find that at wakeuprecovery.com. And then we just continue to get great guests on our magazine, recoverytodaymagazine.com, Recovery Today Magazine. We had Russell Brand last month. That was like an amazing interview.
He's so great. You got to interview him?
I got to interview him, and he's just brilliant. I mean, just brilliant. Oh, my God. Brilliant. He's amazing.
He's amazing
like you, Jean. Amazing like you. So, yeah, that's what I'm working on, just getting my book out there, getting this Wake Up Recovery community out there, and then, you know, to be honest, you know, maybe working just a tad bit less, you know, having some more self-care.
Good for you. That's important, too, and you've made an amazing contribution to the world of recovery, and I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to talk to you and to share a little bit more about you with our guests or with our listeners.
Aww.
And I know
you,
that our paths will cross again. And I also want to let our listeners know that they can visit your website, which is sherrygaba.com, SherryGaba.com. You've got some terrific resources on there. There's quizzes and articles and links to your books and your ebooks, and there's so much on there. So that's a really great place for people to dig into, and I'll be checking out wakeuprecovery.com after I finish
this
interview because I'm excited about all of that. So
thank you. And you keep doing the good work that you're doing because
you
are amazing too.
I really love this. I mean, this not only helps me in my life, all the people that I get to talk to and connect with, but, you know, we just all are lights. We just shine our lights, and this is why I think that recovery is changing, because we're not hiding that anymore. We're shining it, and I'm really, really happy to be part of it, and I'm glad to meet people like you along the way. It's so exciting.
Thank you so much again.
So before you go, just I wonder if you have any last words of encouragement or insight for our listeners who might be struggling a little bit today or thinking that they're ready to make some changes and not sure what to do next.
You know, just the fact that they're on this call, they've already, you know, taken the first step of awareness, and to congratulate themselves for being right here, right now, and having the courage to take a look at something maybe they've been afraid to walk through, but they've taken the time today to listen to this call, and, you know, to be aware that they're aware now, and they're ready to take that step when they're ready. And this was a good step to start that journey for them.
Sherry, thank you so much. And I look forward to our next conversation. I know that it won't be forever until that happens again, but congratulations on your book, and thank you for all that you do.
Thank you again.
All right, listeners, this is The Bubble Hour. You can find us at blogtalkradio.com/bubblehour, and, of course, I'm on Facebook, and you can read my blog at unpickledblog.com, which tells my story, and there's lots of resources and links there as well. You've been listening to me talk to Sherry Gaba, sherrygaba.com, and also wakeuprecovery.com. So that's it for this week of The Bubble Hour. Thanks for listening, everyone, and until next time, take good care.
I just want to be free.